at the back? Yes, good, all right. Reach behind you into the little parachute and grab the Bible that you've got there and turn to page 840. 840, and Mike is here and is going to read Daniel chapter 3. So either follow it in your Bible or just listen to Mike's lovely tones. Daniel chapter 3, page 840.
Daniel chapter 3. It's a long reading. Here we go. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide. So that's about 27 meters tall and about 3 meters wide. And set it up on the plain of Jura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, the prefects, the governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sounds of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever. Your majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If the God we serve is able to deliver us, then he will deliver us from the blazing furnace and from your majesty's hand. But if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude towards them changed. He ordered the furnace to be heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisers, "Were there three men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, Your Majesty." He said, "Look, I see four men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the fourth looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisers crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their heads singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. It is a long reading, but thank you very much for bringing it to life in that way. I think it's worth saying right at the start that Nebuchadnezzar was a real king. It's sometimes tempting to think that when we open this book, particularly the Old Testament, every week, that it ought to sit on the shelf alongside fairy tales. But in fact, any number of historians and archaeologists will tell you that Nebuchadnezzar was a real king and that he reigned from 605 BC to 562 BC. So this is a real person. And at the center of this account are three Jewish civil servants in his government in Babylon, so in the neighboring state, the enemy state. We know their names, but we don't know anything else about them. They've got there by merit. They were effective in their jobs. And so far, their allegiance to the God of Israel hadn't got them into particular trouble. Their unwillingness to eat the royal food, if you remember this from chapter 1, had done them really no harm at all. Because, in fact, since then, they'd moved up the ranks of the civil service in Babylon. But now, out of nowhere, comes a severe test. Out of nowhere, as is so often the case in life, isn't it? The king had put up this huge monument. I did my own calculations. 90 feet high, 9 feet wide. Does that sound about right? Big old thing. Big enough for everyone to see and positioned on a plain in the middle of nowhere so that everyone could see it and get the best possible view. Now, why the king put it there, we're not told. Maybe it was a monument to himself. Maybe it was just a big royal project by a man with some time on his hands and plenty of money and plenty of pride. It doesn't really matter why it was there. The fact is that the great and the good of Babylon were invited to put on their finery and come and fall down in worship to the thing. The monument. A satrap, by the way, is a provincial governor in Babylon, in the Persian Empire. I had to look that up, but there's the answer. Refusal to bow down would be met by death in a blazing furnace. So I'm left with the impression that this was a national event with nowhere to hide. And it seems to be a very early example of a system which can grip a nation at any time called totalitarianism. So basically a system requiring complete obedience to the state. And if that sounds familiar from history when you were at school, Living in Germany under Nazi rule before and during the Second World War is an example of that. Living in North Korea today sounds to be a current example. It's the sort of culture of tyranny which has a habit of finding its way to Christians and saying, "What about you?" And when totalitarianism comes along, it tends to separate. So, for example, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a Lutheran priest living under Nazi rule, he found himself on the wrong side of the state and he was executed at the end of the war because he refused to stop criticizing the Nazi government in circumstances not unlike those facing Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, strikingly, for Dietrich Bonhoeffer, there was no escape from the hangman's noose, and we will come back to that. Now, we don't face the risk of martyrdom in this country for being Christian, but there are countless examples of situations in this country where Christians here and abroad have found themselves overlooked or disadvantaged in their work for refusing to compromise on an issue of Christian principle. Equality laws, which are well-intentioned and which have the aim of rooting out discrimination, have ended up being used as sticks to beat Christians with. Cancel culture is the up-to-date expression, and it can catch Christians out at a moment's notice. Back to our three men, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. They appear to be doing well in their careers. They've risen through the ranks of a foreign civil service. That itself is no mean feat. I can't think of a modern parallel where three men from one nation become prominent in the civil service of another nation. They've done well. They have kept their noses clean as believers. They have stayed out of trouble. And perhaps most significantly, they never appear to have been told by anyone to renounce their faith, to give it up. Although living and working in Babylon in the enemy state, it seems to have been at least tolerated that they worshipped the God of Israel. However, suddenly news comes that they've been denounced by some astrologers. They've been grassed up, not to put too fine a point in it, for their refusal to bow down and worship the image of a god. And this puts them on a direct collision course with the king. Now, take a moment to put yourself in their shoes at the point where you learn that direct confrontation with the king is coming because someone has reported them. What would you and I do? Where would our instincts lie? We'd all like to think that we'd do what they did. Instead, I think my instinct would be to keep my head down, to find some polite form of words in explanation for my refusal to worship the golden image, which allows me to carry on with my job and live a quiet life. It would be for me, and I suspect I'm not alone, massively tempting to count the cost, decide that the cost is too high because it inconvenienced me, and cut a deal. Maybe I might offer to go back to Israel and just quietly get on with being in the civil service there. Or it might be just worth a quick nod of the head to the golden image, even if not necessarily a full-scale bow. Now, for three experienced civil servants, going to a high-end civic event doesn't sound particularly challenging. But to keep the king happy, they are being asked to do something else, a little bit of addition to their faith. No need to give up your faith, guys. Not at all. Just do the extra thing. Just fall down and worship that monument, would you? Don't worry. Everyone else will be doing it. You won't stand out, quite the reverse. You'll blend in. It would just be polite, and in fact, it would just be a bit rude if you didn't. Oh, and by the way, there's the blazing furnace. Let's bring that up to date. Thank you for agreeing to speak at the school assembly, but if you could just please emphasize the value of all faiths for salvation, if you could just please avoid direct reference to Jesus as Lord of Lords, nothing too radical, please. Don't want to put any noses out of joint. Here's a newspaper report from 2017 about what happened to a friend of ours. A vicar at a Tunbridge Wells church has hit back at parents after they withdrew their children from assembly, citing concerns over extremist Christian teaching. The vicar, I won't name him, who has been taking assemblies at blank Church of England Primary School for 24 years, says it's parents who are extremist and not the church or Christian-based charity Crossteach. In a statement, he said, the behaviour of this small group of parents has hurled a hand grenade into previously happy and harmonious environment. They seem determined to drive mainstream Christian teaching out of our church school, and it is they, not ourselves, who should be charged with the extremism and non-exclusiveness. The church vicar said that he'd never been asked to withdraw or apologise for anything he'd said or done at the school. The statement comes after the head teacher wrote to parents on Monday informing them that Crossteach and a small number of individuals linked to the church would no longer be invited into lessons or assemblies. The school governors are currently considering a formal complaint made by a group of 25 parents concerning extremist Christian teaching, which they say is being promoted in lessons and assemblies. No, said the three civil servants, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. This is our line. Sorry. And they said it as if it came as naturally as breathing. What they said was this: O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of God you've set up. They said it as if it came as naturally as breathing. There was a really interesting question on Twitter last week. It was this: what subject, just answer this in your nut, what subject could you talk on for 30 minutes without any preparation? What a good question that is. What subject could you talk on for 30 minutes, without any preparation? Now, some good friends of mine here could talk about football for 5 days solid without any preparation. And there are all sorts of topics represented in this room. So, speaking for myself, I might go have a go at history for 30 minutes until you beg me to stop. But the answer to the question will reveal something about where our hearts lie. Something of where our hearts lie. So compared to your own favourite day-to-day subject, whether it's football or whatever, how easy or difficult would you find it, to talk about Jesus for 30 minutes, without any preparation? If I tried to do that, would I get distracted? Would I dry up and run out of things to say? I have the impression that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were able to say, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up, because for them, talking about God was as natural as breathing. They knew their king, they knew his power, they knew that he was able to save them, verse 17. And the way they expressed it was so completely straightforward. The God we serve is able to save us. Solid confidence, right there. They made it sound so natural. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they're not the heroes of this story. They're just ordinary men. I'm quite sure that they wouldn't want it to be any other way. They're not the heroes of this story. It is God alone who saves, and in fact makes sure in this account that not a hair on their head is singed. But, I have been very struck and deeply challenged when preparing this talk by how natural they seemed under intense pressure. Where does it come from? Well, I think it comes from a solid confidence in God. When I was a young Christian, we used to sing, I'm not going to sing it for you, thank goodness. We used to sing a chorus, long gone now, but if you are my sort of age, you might remember it. It had the line, and I'm not going to sing it, I promise, although it's very tempting. No one can touch you when you're standing on the rock. Does that ring? Am I the only person that... No, okay. No one can touch you when you're standing on the rock. It went very deep for me, that line. I'll say it once more. No one can touch you when you're standing on the rock. And I store that away. And I think our men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, give off some of that solid rock-standing confidence. What they knew at a DNA level was that God is powerful to save. They were standing on the rock. Now, the death of the Queen on Thursday has changed our idea of sovereignty. On Wednesday night, we had one sovereign. By Thursday night, we automatically, by operation of law, had a new sovereign. Sovereignty means absolute power. There aren't many kings and queens left these days, but every single one of them claims absolute sovereignty, absolute power. And in our constitution, absolute sovereignty has now passed to the king, King Charles III. Countries claim sovereignty within their borders, and it gets very complicated when they also claim sovereignty over their own subjects when they're abroad. It keeps lawyers in business. If you have a passport, it gives a very good example. Here's mine, and yours, if you have one, says exactly the same thing on the inside cover. Soon to be changed, this, but Her Britannic Majesty's Secretary of State, I think that's the Home Secretary or Foreign Secretary, requests and requires, in the name of Her Majesty, all those whom it may concern to allow the bearer to pass freely without let or hindrance and to afford the bearer such assistance and protection as may be necessary. So the holder of this passport is my subject, says the passport. Let him pass, let her pass. It's a glimpse, it's no more than that, it's a glimpse of the power balance we have with God. The great power is loyal to its subjects. Let my subjects pass freely. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego knew that they worshipped a great power, the great power which protects and saves. But right at the heart of this passage, right in the guts of it, I think are the most compelling six words in the Old Testament. And I'm going to emphasize them as I read this again. If we're thrown into a blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O King. But even if he does not, we want you to know, O King, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up. That phrase, even if he does not, but even if he does not, is a six-word declaration that is capable of obliterating all fear, cancelling all opposition, and putting our feet back on the rock. But even if he does not, we have a solid confidence in God nevertheless, whatever opposition we face. Now, there's a slightly older version of the Bible than the one we're using. It's called the Revised Standard Version. It's the one I grew up with. And it gets it down to three words, even more punchy. And I'm going to read it again with three words substituted this time. We do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O King. But if not, we want you to know, O King, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. But if not, I will have confidence in God anyway. It's like a concrete slab being lifted off us. The greatest potential for disappointment in the Christian life lies in believing that God will cave and give in to my requests, which are really demands. If I pray, God will answer in the way that I demand, right? Wrong. The mechanics of prayer don't work like that. It isn't a deal, it isn't a contract, and there aren't lists to be ticked. It's not the God we serve will give me everything we want. It's not the God we serve is at our command. Instead, remember those three words. Take them out into Three Colts Lane with you. But if not, please cure my friend of his illness. Please cure my friend of his illness. But if not, please give me a life partner. But if not, I would love this promotion. But if not. And that's it right there, isn't it? That's the whole of the Christian life right there. The God we serve is able to save us. Do Do you see the point? Whether God does save us from the furnace, from the here and now, is of no consequence. We trust him because we know he will ultimately save us. So if we face trouble because of our faith, which is guaranteed to happen at some point if we're public about it, if we have a furnace experience, God is able to save us, but if not, we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you've set up. There was a First World War military chaplain called the Reverend William Studdart Kennedy. You can picture him. He smoked a pipe. He looked like a First World War military chaplain, all right? He was known in the trenches as Woodbine Willie because he carried boxes of cigarettes for the troops. When his wife wrote to him at the front and told him that she'd had a son, he wrote back and told her this: "The first prayer I want my son to learn to say for me is not, 'God keep Daddy safe,' but 'God make Daddy brave. And if he has hard things to do, make him strong to do them.'" That's a little replica of the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego story. Not keep us safe, but make us brave. Let's go back to the king. Let's recall how this started. King Nebuchadnezzar had made an image of gold 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. 28 verses later, he's saying this: "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants." Who was that fourth man, by the way? Very difficult to know. Some Bible commentators have said it's the pre-incarnate Jesus, just a glimpse of Jesus, because the whole arc of the Old Testament points towards Jesus. "Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other god can save in this way." That is quite the handbrake turn. I think it's fair to say that Nebuchadnezzar's heart was changed by what he'd seen. He goes from being powerful and proud and, to be honest, a bit ridiculous, to being rather helpless. Put another way, he goes from being the king to acknowledging the king. So his heart was changed by what he'd seen with his own eyes in the furnace, but it started with the declaration of faith from the three civil servants. And of the two things, so the words and the furnace, I think it was the words that counted just as much, if not more, because as they were led up to the furnace, those words had already set the tone. We have really powerful words at our disposal. Words that can save. "Jesus is Lord," for example. Over and over again, we will be tempted to put them away for a rainy day, to dilute them, to quickly calculate the cost, to clam up, to change the subject. I've done it 1,000 times. Parading the words of faith, getting them out, declaring trust in Jesus is costly. It will lead to trouble, no question. At the very least, it will lead to ridicule and pity, and nobody chases after that. And not everyone will be spared the furnace. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was not spared the hangman's noose. Weekly, sometimes daily, there are credible accounts of martyrdom for the sake of Jesus throughout the world, even if not in Europe. People are still dying today because of, and only because of, their publicly declared faith in Jesus. Think about that today and this week. But note how Nebuchadnezzar's heart was changed and how his country, in all likelihood, was changed as a result, because Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not swerve. For them, it was as natural as breathing. The words of that chaplain to his wife once more. The first prayer I want my son to learn to say for me is not keep daddy safe, but make daddy brave. And if he has hard things to do, make him strong to do them.